Hi, and welcome to the Bits and Trees podcast. I'm your host, Matt Machuga, and joining me today is Phil Sturgeon. Hi, Phil.
Hello, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks. How are you?
Not too bad.
Excellent. For those who don't know you, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
I am a developer working for WeWork at the moment. I guess the latest title that I've given myself is a platform engineer or some sort of architect. I like to change the title of my job every year and just come up with a new cool term for doing computer stuff. But
nice.
Yeah, like a lot of what I work on is API design and kind of systems architecture and how to make systems talk to each other without completely clobbering each other or falling over or changing so much the other system doesn't recognize what it's doing, things like that.
So today I brought you on to talk a little bit about some APIs, maybe dispel some myths about REST APIs in general, if that works all right for you.
Sure. I mean, it'd be a bit awkward if I said no now, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Short and sweet.
Just talk about bikes. Let's just talk about bikes for the next hour. That way.
You know what? I'm not too against talking about bikes for an hour. That would be great.
Different podcast, though, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So you're pretty well known for talking about REST APIs in general. Can you tell us why you think that REST APIs are still a great idea in 2018?
Yeah, absolutely. REST APIs generally are kind of seen as old and, you know, a bad idea because they were released in the year 2000, right? And the idea is that everything newer is better. And people think that, you know, folks like Facebook and Google, who have built kind of alternatives to REST, they think that because they have built newer systems by looking at the things REST couldn't do and then making this new system, they must, you know, these new systems must be better than REST. But really, generally, people don't understand what REST is, and that's been a huge problem for the entire time it's existed. People think that REST just means like JSON over HTTP, which it isn't. So because of people not really understanding what REST does, they misuse it. But because REST is also considered the metric of quality, they want to call it REST. So you have all these things that got nothing to do with REST whatsoever, that people are calling REST, and therefore people think it's bad. And therefore, the APIs aren't of the highest quality, so they start to look for alternatives. And you have a lot of new systems that just do different stuff that aren't better or worse. They're just for completely different use cases. And we've noticed that a lot of people just kind of run around saying, you know, GraphQL is the best thing, use it for everything, or gRPC is the best thing, use it for everything. And people used to shout, REST is the best thing, use it for everything. And before that, it was SOAP is the best, use it for everything. So I've been a huge proponent of REST in the past, and I was being a bit ignorant because I was saying REST is the best, use it for pretty much everything. And now that I've recognized this pattern, I want to try and help be part of the solution to stop us from just, you know, bandwagoning straight onto the latest thing and just rewriting everything into some new kind of API paradigm and ignoring the lessons of different paradigms and ignoring the use cases for when different things are good for different things.
Yeah, ignoring the tribalism behind these technologies is probably a good choice.
I was going to say, it's funny that you say tribalism, because from the old Laravel community, or the PHP community, that was a big problem I was trying to fight against there, right? It was like all these different frameworks, and you'd have all these little groups of people that were like, this framework is the best in the world, the rest of them are rubbish. And then you'd have other people saying the exact same thing about their thing. And occasionally people would switch, which was hugely embarrassing, because then they'd have to say, actually, no, this is the best thing. I was wrong before. And really, most of the time, it's just different use cases. So I'm trying to kind of take that mindset and apply it to APIs to help people build awesome systems and use the right tool for the job, you know?
Right. Yeah, I remember Rails and MERB had the same issue before they merged way back in the day. It was almost like they were used for the same thing like many of the PHP frameworks were, but there was the whole us versus them mentality. And then they wound up getting together and, okay, we're not too different. Let's just merge.
Yeah, that was good. But then there's the other types of framework that are like Sinatra, you know, and it would be like saying, which is better, Rails or Sinatra? Like, how could you possibly say either one of them is better? They're two totally different things. And that's where we're at with API paradigms. There's a bunch of different paradigms that are fully for different things. It's not just different flavors of the same idea most of the time. They're like fully different concepts.
Right. So with that in mind, let's address the two biggest contenders right now, at least the two that you tend to hear about the most. We have REST, and then we have GraphQL.
Yes.
It seems like people are trying to throw GraphQL at everything, and it seems to have strong suits that it's well suited for. When do you think you might pick GraphQL over REST?
Sure. One thing that GraphQL has, which makes it fantastic, is the fact that everything is built all as one package, right? Like, you can just download a GraphQL server, and there are pre-built kind of GraphQL clients that you can just tweak and configure. And so you have like the one website that you go to where you get all of the tools that you need and all of the docs that go with those tools. And then you've got the whole thing. That's really, really useful for inexperienced API developers that don't have time to sit down and go through kind of 10 different standards and cobble together their own REST API out of different bits and bobs, right? Even if you're kind of ignoring the standards with REST APIs, you have to sit down and say, okay, I want to. I'll use this URL naming convention, and I'll use this data format, and I'll use this metadata format. And you have to pick different things. You know, you cobble together JSON API and JSON schema and whatever else. Whereas GraphQL says, here is everything that you will need. That's obviously a bit of a pain in the butt if you want to go outside those rules, because they are saying, like, here are the conventions, here is how everything fits together. But you can't really go outside of that. So that is a bit of a downside. But kind of being one package is the biggest benefit for GraphQL. But there's a lot of other really cool things too. Like, the fact that it has a type system built into that package means that you get all the benefits of having a type system means you get the benefits of a type system. What am I trying to say here? A lot of people kind of ignore type systems from REST APIs. Like, I did an entire book without mentioning type systems at any point, right? The benefit of a type system is, instead of just flinging around kind of arbitrary JSON and you're like, here are some fields, figure it out. Go look at the docs, right? The type system says these fields exist. These fields are required. These fields are a string or an integer or something else. And you get all of that functionality like baked in. It's not optional. You have to use the types, which is a really cool thing if you want the type system in your API.
Now, is that guaranteed by the protocol itself, or is it still up to the library implementers to decide they want to implement the type portion?
I would assume it's up to the implementations, but I've never seen one be flagrantly ignored. I think people are kind of advertising it as the main benefit, so it'd be strange to go outside of that.
Yeah, it's hard to do like a full apple-to-apple comparison, because I'm unfamiliar with which parts are part of the spec, which parts are part of the library, what's optional, what's mandatory. But then again, we run into the same thing in REST, where REST is defined in Roy Fielding's paper, and then Rails comes along and says, well, I'm doing REST. And then the rest right. of the world thinks that they're doing REST after that.
Yeah, which is two completely different things. They couldn't be further from each other.
Right. So what do you think about Rails REST contrasts with the original definition of REST?
Rails was pretty much the major proponent of the myth that REST means JSON over HTTP, right? All they really did in the early days of Rails, all it was really doing was saying, like, you've already got these collections and you've got these resources. You already have this like URL structure, which is, you know, /foos/1, and that will be your collection and your resource. Then they were just saying, like, oh, and shove.json on the end, and now it's an API. Hooray! like an API design should just be an accidental happening and just happen to be some JSON instead of the HTML that you're outputting. So that was a bit weird. And much later on, so starting from Rails 4, they started to add a lot more API-specific functionality in there, and it got really good. There's a lot of useful tooling in there, but they never really changed. They never got any closer to actually doing anything RESTful at all, at any point. It's still, like, Rails REST is still doesn't do anything that makes it REST. I'm being a bit vague here, so if you look at something called the Richardson Maturity Model, right, it's a really useful thing, and I'm going to have to probably open it up to remember the exact levels of it. But the idea of the Richardson Maturity Model is it's a visual representation of the layers of abstraction on top of RPC that take you to REST. So REST is considered just a series of abstractions on top of RPC. RPC is like, I have a method name and some arguments. Do the thing, say hello, send this message, whatever, right? You just have a method name and you have a series of arguments. But REST is meant to be a whole bunch on top of that. And the Richardson Maturity Model shows you the levels. So while I'm frantically Googling it, here we go. Martin Fowler has a wonderful blog post. And the idea is there's three different levels. Zero is the Swamp of Pox, they call it. That stands for, like, piece of XML. So you're just flinging XML around. Level one is resources. Level two is HTTP verbs. And level three is hypermedia control. So hypermedia controls is another term for HATIOS, the acronym that everyone hates. That's the bit where you start talking about REST. You start talking about REST and you mention HATIOS, and people are like, I don't know what that means. It sounds like supervillain serial, but I don't really know how to put that in my API. So everyone kind of ignores level three, and then they just literally have an RPC API operating over HTTP with some JSON and some like SEO optimized URLs for no apparent reason, right? So level one, the resources and collections. People think that means that you have to have a collection of things and then a specific resource. So you have to have slash users, and then you have to have slash users 123. That's not really what resource means. REST API isn't about CRUD. But you do want to have some concepts of resources to play with, and that could be a singleton resource, or it could be a sub-resource. There's a lot of different types of resource you can have. But that just separates it out from things like GraphQL that operate on a single endpoint. The benefit of having resources, and really they just mean the benefit of having different endpoints, is that you can start to do a lot of different conventions around that. Like the idea that anything can be represented with a truly global ID, right? And not just a UUID, but the whole URL. That's the concept of resources. And then the level two is HTTP verbs, which Rails did add. They have, you know, get, post, put, delete. They also kind of added patch support in, but they just made patch be an alias for put, which is just completely not what they're for at all. That's really annoying. It's still the case. They've just never fixed it. They don't care. So they got to level two in Rails, and it took a while to get to level two. Everything was get and post for a while. But then level three has just not been touched. And it's quite difficult for level three, for the HATIOS stuff to be done with a web framework. Because the idea of, like, once you output a resource, being able to link to another resource, well, that depends heavily on the serializer that you're using. So if you kind of output a JSON representation of, you know, some data model that you happen to have in your database or whatever it is, if you output that, the web framework doesn't have a serializer built in, so they don't really know how. And how you represent links from one resource to another, or whatever it is you're doing, that very much depends on the data format you're using. So if you're using HAL or Siren or Uber or JSON API or some sort of homegrown thing like that, that's quite hard to do. So Rails got to level two and then kind of went, nah, that's close enough. We'll keep calling it REST. It's not, but nah, it's hard.
Mm-hmm. So how important do you find level three? Level two? Did I just one index these?
It's fine. It's zero index. So level two is pretty important. Were you asking about HTTP verbs, the level you're asking about?
No, I was aiming for HATIOS.
Okay, right. So HATIOS isn't something you should try and jam into everything, right? It's a very important concept that you should know about. Basically, HATIOS is... A lot of people think that it's just about, like, you can rename your URLs without breaking things. And, like, no, that's not... We're not just trying to rename URLs. That doesn't add that much value. The general idea is that REST is designed to be a state machine over HTTP. So, or a state machine over any protocol, really, but it's realistically usually used over HTTP. So with HATIOS, you can have an invoice, and you can have a series of available actions, one of which could be pay. And the pay link only shows up if the invoice is payable and the bearer token being used to fetch that invoice is assigned to somebody who has the ability to pay that invoice, right? Mm-hmm. So you can start to build... REST is a really good choice for BFFs. You know, the BFF architectural pattern?
I do not.
Oh, cool. So BFF is backends for frontends. The idea generally being you don't necessarily want... If you have, like, a... multiple similar clients, you know, like you have a web version and an Android version and an iOS version, and they're all completely different code bases, then you don't necessarily want to have a bunch of repeated client logic in every single one of them. A lot of people make these really generic APIs, which is good to do. We all advocated the idea of building generic APIs that all your clients can use, but you start to find extra functionality being required on top of that, especially when you get to try and work out like which type of user can do which type of thing. So a BFF is a really good way. You build an API that will be used by a group of clients or maybe a single client, and you build shared logic into that BFF that wouldn't necessarily be at home in the main API. So you can have general data stores, and these can be in GraphQL or whatever the heck, what anything, file system, CSV files. But then you build your BFFs to be the interface that those clients will talk to. And so the main APIs can change quicker, but the BFFs will have to maintain their contract until they know that their clients are ready to upgrade. And that kind of helps with evolution and a bunch of other problems. But the cool thing about that is that it means REST can provide a lot of like UI updates and functionality. Like when you imagine the most basic CMS, and you always have those, you know, rows of fields, and then you have like the actions button next to it, and there's a list of drop down actions, right? Mm-hmm. When you just use REST-ish, or you just use kind of CRUD APIs, and you just have fields being pinged back up and down, then all of your clients have to say, okay, if the status of this invoice equals this, and the user is of this type, and this other thing is this other thing, then okay, they're allowed to see the pay button. And for this other button, here are some other rules. And you have all these different rules for every single little bit of the UI. And really, you could just bung that into Hatios, and the JSON API, you know, the REST API, would give you a list of actions that are available, and then you just check to see if that link relation is available in order to show the button. Or you dynamically just show whatever turns up. And that's like one of many use cases for like a state machine over HTTP being useful.
Right. And that's why they call it hypermedia as an engine, right? Like you're using it to drive the website, or you're using it to drive the API.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Does GraphQL or even like, let's say SOAP, do either of those have anything analogous to this?
No. SOAP, inside the Wizzle, there's a whole bunch of stuff you can do, and you can kind of show like other related actions. I've not had too much experience playing with that with SOAP, but SOAP is essentially glorified up. Well, SOAP is literally RPC with a type system. So it doesn't really get into the realm of trying to provide related actions and be a state machine over HTTP. It just kind of, here's a bunch of messages that you could make. Here's a bunch of actions that you could take, but not necessarily in relation to this current resource right now. GraphQL doesn't have any of this. I have seen some people, like I posted a blog post called Representing State in REST and GraphQL, which is about this exact topic in quite a bunch of depth. And some people, I can't remember who they work for or what they do. There's a fellow from GitHub, I think. He started working on basically hypermedia for GraphQL, and they're kind of interested in seeing what they can do there. And it's kind of cool. But basically the idea would be, when you fetch a resource, you get a bunch of JSON back, and there could be a actions field, and that field could be an array of strings that has a list of available mutations, and then you can use kind of introspection to see what those mutations would take. And you can kind of build super basic hypermedia control stuff there. That's not really hypermedia. There's nothing hypermedia-y about it. Because obviously hypermedia, the H comes from HTTP and all that stuff. But it's basically a bunch of conventions that are very GraphQL specific, which you can still get it done, but it's very GraphQL specific conventions, which mean that you could only ever do it with your one API. With Hatios in, you know, proper Hatios in REST, you could very easily say, like YouTube, they have a video upload thing. You send the one post request, which creates the video metadata. And then after that, they give you a URL, which you can fire off the actual video to, right? You could start off with that URL being a actual part of your current API, and then you could seamlessly change that to be a different service entirely. So things like that make Hatios a little bit nicer, because you can swap around who owns what. You can say, you need to post to this URL with these fields, and here are the validation rules, And then it doesn't really matter if that server is your server or a different server. You can follow it to that website, and you can follow it to another website, and then come back to yours, and you can literally crawl around the web. That's why when people talk about REST and HTTPS being like how the internet works, it's literally how every single HTTP page you go to, every HTML page, it's all using the concept of REST. You follow links, you click around, you can take certain actions in certain concepts. It's the same as a user browsing around. If you build if you have a hypermedia client, then you can do the same stuff. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I found reading through his Roy Fielding's white paper that it was very much just like reading the HTTP spec.
Yeah, well, they were involved in both of them. Like HTTP borrows from REST and REST borrows from HTTP. They're not the same, but the same person was writing both of them. So there's a lot of the same concepts involved.
Right. So going back to having a universal resource identifier, there's a lot of misconceptions that say like, well, if I have this user's endpoint, this is my only way of representing anything. And then people will complain that they need to have nested resources or they have to have extra data if they have a mobile view. What are some tips you could offer people who feel limited by HTTP or limited by REST in this situation?
Yeah, that can be super tricky. Different mobile devices. I worked for a company in the past called Ride, and they went bankrupt. Not my fault, but there was a web view, there was an iOS app, and there was an Android app, right? And every single one of these teams, they wanted to make what I call the mega include of Doom. You know, people I'm sure are familiar with this kind of thing from GraphQL, but this exact same problem exists in JSON API, where you can say, give me this resource and include this thing and this thing and then this other thing and this other stuff. And you can go like multiple levels deep with that. It's really useful if used in moderation, but it can cause really bad problems. Like you can request so much stuff from a server that doesn't have whitelists and that doesn't limit how many levels deep you can go. You can request so much stuff that you can crash the server, or you spend like 10 seconds trying to construct the thing. It's really unfortunate that HTTP 2 is still being ignored to the level it's being ignored, because HTTP 2 solves pretty much every single problem anyone has with REST. REST obviously being an older thing, well, REST being an older concept and being implemented mostly in HTTP 1.1 makes people think that you have to make as fewer round trips as possible. You want to, you know, make as few fetches as you possibly can, because you have to wait for the HTTP handshake and the SSL and all the other stuff. That's not been true since HTTP 1.1. That was true in HTTP 1.0. But using Keep Alive is really cool. Make sure your client uses Keep Alive so it's just quicker with the handshakes. But HTTP 2 solves most of the problems, because instead of trying to fetch one giant piece of information, instead of, you know, selecting slash me and include everything about me ever in this entire website and everything related to my friends and everything I might need to see, which a lot of people do, you can just request the thing that's, you know, request slash me and then follow the hypermedia links to other bits that might be useful. And if you're implementing HTTP caching, there's a very good chance that because you have smaller, more targeted endpoints, you're going to end up hitting the HTTP cache for some of those things. Whereas if you try and make a fetch me all the things endpoint, then you're going to miss that cache pretty much every time, because, you know, it's fetching so much stuff. If you're fetching resource A and it relates to, you know, collection B and C and D, those whole collections might be in the cache, or other related items might be in the cache. But if you select everything, then you're going to end up missing the cache pretty much every time. So it's tricky. REST is seen as inflexible, but really it's seen as, I see it as like more controlled and more like refined. And instead of saying to your clients, you have absolute ability to do anything you want, you say like, here are some things that we expect that you need. If you need something else, you can ask us for it. We can make an aggregate endpoint if it's really necessary. But if the needs of two clients are wildly different from each other, that's when a BFF starts to make sense. And if you have larger development teams, then you have the ability to go off and say, okay, Frank is going to work on the BFF for this one, and Sarah's going to work on the BFF for this other client. That can be tricky with smaller teams where you don't really have the power to split. But generally speaking, if your clients are super different, you probably need different APIs for them. Otherwise, you're making something that's so generic that it's not really fitting the needs of anyone.
Right. I find most of the questions I get are related to the having a resource identifier match what Rails would do, or they would match this exact situation where people feel like they can't be flexible about what a resource returns. So I feel like I have to kind of nudge people out of that mindset where the Rails way or the Laravel way, they're not the only ways to represent your resources, and you can do more with it. You just can't like limit your mindset. And then I'm glad you brought up the caching, because caching and REST is, I don't want to oversimplify it by saying incredibly easy, but compared to a lot of the other options, it's much nicer to deal with. What are some of the qualities of caching with REST?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say easy, because it's both really easy and really not. So much like pretty much anything, like pretty much any standard out there is actually quite complex under the hood. But like if you want to install an OAuth 2 server, you can go out and install the PHP League's, you know, OAuth 2 server for PHP, and it's just awesome and it works and you follow the README, you don't have to do anything. But if you were to sit down and try and implement every single piece of an OAuth 2 server, not only would you have a really bad month building it, but you'd get hacked in the second month and it would be very upsetting for everyone. So usually following complex standards isn't something you necessarily want to do by hand. So the best thing about the HTTP caching situation is that there's middlewares for pretty much every single language. The HTTP caching can be done at the most basic level by just your application server saying, this response expires in an hour, and that's it. Clients can completely ignore that, and they can still keep on hitting you. So it's not like security against rate limiting, but it's just a hint to people that want to listen to those hints that says how long this information is relevant for. Now that's super simple step one. And you know, time-based caching obviously doesn't take into account invalidations, and cache invalidations is one of the three or four hardest things. But you can skip the concept of invalidation almost entirely for your API by using etags and other conditional validation methods, where you basically say, the most simple implementation is usually like an MD5 hash of the updated at time next to the ID. That's a overly simplistic way of thinking about etags, but in a very kind of CRUD-based API it works. So you can say, you know, user one was last updated at now, 5 minutes ago, whatever the timestamp is, and give them back that etag in the response. And then the next request that's made for that same URL, you can then say, here's an etag. Has it been changed since this etag? Like, does this etag match? And they'll be like, oh, no, that's different. Here's the new thing. So you don't have to worry about consistently having all of your clients invalidate all of their caches. They'll just do that when they try and make a request. And they'll say, oh, it's past the timestamp, so I should try requesting again, or oh, the etag doesn't match. There's loads of levels of stuff that can be done, and you can do that on the client side. You can also do it on the network level. You can slap a network cache. You can use hosted ones like Fastly, Varnish, or whatever else. You can just shove that in front of your API as a proxy, and clients will continue to make requests and hit the network cache. Or you can use both. So the client knows that it doesn't need to bother making a request right now, and then when it does, it goes to the network cache, which hopefully is geographically closer to where your clients are if you've been setting it up properly. And then the network cache will work out if it should bother the application server, which means you don't need quite as many application servers trying to consistently answer loads and loads and loads of questions from loads of different clients all over the world. You just have these different levels of caching. So another amazing thing that I heard of last month that I'd never even thought about was in lots of parts of Africa where they have really kind of crappy internet. They have for quite a long time been using networking caches themselves that the APIs don't know anything about. Like they're routing their traffic through network caching layers so they can get to, you know, bbc.com to see the news, because it will add extra caching to the internet as they're browsing it. So there's so many amazing things. Like that's part of the benefit of following generic HTTP standards instead of having kind of implementation specific stuff every single time, is that once these conventions are in place, you can build a whole bunch of tooling around these conventions that just works in ways that you wouldn't even think it would work in, because the convention is just so solid.
Yeah, that one's pretty fascinating. I like that use case.
Yeah.
Another thing I like to see is you mentioned geographically locating a cache. Another important use case is if you have everything on the same network or within the same VPC, if you're using something like Amazon, you can completely avoid all those endpoint hits to your primary service with the network cache in the middle. So I like that if you don't have something like gRPC or GraphQL implemented. Are you very familiar with gRPC in general?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, what are some pros and cons over using gRPC over something like REST?
So gRPC, once again, is very well contained. It is like one package that has implementations in most of the languages you're likely to want to use. It's the five official languages that Google consider to be real languages, plus some other ones that other people wrote. Or I can't remember if it's five or three, but there's like a core number of supported ones that Google support for everything. gRPC is a really, really, really good RPC implementation. RPC used to be the bad thing. Like everyone used to make fun of JSON RPC and XML and RPC and SOAP because it was dumb. And that was the argument against... that was the argument for using REST, is that, you know, RPC is dumb and REST is good, so use that. And now it's swung back the other way to, like, RPC is fast. RPC in general is usually considered to be the quickest because you're ignoring all those layers of abstraction, right? You're literally just... do this message, do this thing, get me this resource, do this, and you don't have to worry about any other layers of abstraction or caching or anything else on top. And gRPC adds to that basic principle, and by default uses HTTP2. That's one of the most powerful things about it, is that not only is it a package, a complete package that you can install and run and hello world and you just have a gRPC server, but it has HTTP2 built in, so you can make a whole bunch of requests and it will like multiplex back the responses. And that is very, very cool. So I recommend gRPC be used for anything that could not ever possibly be a REST API, right? Like we have a permission system, and the permission system is literally you send it a bunch of attributes and it says, okay, I'll let you do this thing this one time. You know, send it a user and a company and an action and a building number, because I work in an office management company. You pass it all those attributes and it's like, okay, we'll let you book this room. But that would never be a REST API. You'd have to like create a permission check attempt, and it would be so like contrived and weird to do that. So gRPC is recommended for things that are fundamentally action based, like the Slack API is RPC, and it's fantastic as RPC. Like block a user, great, carry on with your RPC. And also for internal things. So generally WeWork is broken down by different missions, you know, like different kind of larger groups. They're like their own department really, but they're different kind of bunches of engineers, and they work on their own systems. We don't necessarily know what their systems are, we don't necessarily care, but they can use whatever the heck API paradigm they want, whatever's fast for them, whatever's easy for them, as long as they expose a kind of REST gateway that we can then interact with that might kind of aggregate a whole bunch of these various different services in the background, and give us this one kind of more concrete, slowly, carefully evolving API that we can integrate across different departments that aren't in the same continent that, you know, are talking to each other. So gRPC is great for really, really quick little things where you control both ends of the wire and you can deploy things in real time. And you know, you're just firing messages around without any of this HTTPS nonsense. But then when you want to kind of talk to somebody else that you don't know, you need those extra layers of abstraction to help help with the evolution and the change and things like that.
So going back to a little bit of a focus on REST again, how does it work if I want to request something like JSON for my one API, and then my next one would prefer XML responses? How could you approach that with a REST API?
Easy, content types. I mean, some people say you can put a file extension in there, and that's fine, that's perfectly valid. But you can just use the accept header, and when you make a request to whatever the resource is, you say accept application / JSON, or application / XML, or text XML, I don't know. And it will just return a different thing. And again, because you're following generic conventions, every single caching proxy will recognize that that is a different request. It doesn't just make it unique on the URL, it makes it unique on the URL and the content type, and any other headers that you mention might be important, like authentication. And it will just give you back the different representation of that data.
One of the big things that comes along with creating an API is finding a good way to document it. I know there's some tools for REST. I don't know what else is out there, but can you go over, you know, the tools that you find helpful? I don't know if that's something like Swagger or something else.
Sure. Yeah. So Swagger doesn't exist anymore. It's called OpenAPI now. And it is actually very, very good. I used to really not like Swagger back when it was called Swagger. I think Swagger 1.2 was out and it was just really bad. But OpenAPI v3 is fantastic. I use a lot of JSON Schema, and OpenAPI and JSON Schema are pretty much the same thing when it comes to describing the contents of the body. I'm probably starting at the wrong end of this. So, hey, so OpenAPI is a API description language, and it can describe the service layer, which is here are my URLs, and here are my methods, and here's a description of what they do. And here are the parameters that I accept on these URLs, and here are the headers that you can expect to see and on the request and on the response rate. That's all super useful stuff. And then there's this like the schema level, and that is some people call it the data model, and you're just kind of saying inside the response you will see this XML or JSON. This is the data that you're going to get back, and the schema contains all the rules about this field is required, this field is optional, this one can be a string, this one might be a string or a null, and you have human readable descriptions for all of those as well. So a lot of people see them as two very distinct separate things. You have your code, and then at some point you sit down and you write out all this blooming YAML so that you have documentation. But I try and bring the two things conceptually together a lot more. We at WeWork use OpenAPI for loads and loads and loads of stuff. We write OpenAPI before we write any code so that we can then use something called mocking. And mocking will basically say, you give it your OpenAPI file and it will build a fake server for you, which is, you know, all the endpoints and all the data responses, and it's all fake and it works perfectly fine. And you can like play around with that and give it to your clients and they can test integrate and all that stuff. Then that same OpenAPI, when you're ready, you can put it into a GitHub repo and start coding. Put it in the repo that you're actually going to build your API in, and you can use that same stuff as contract tests. So you can run your code. You have some sort of test suite that looks at the OpenAPI and just mushes it against the actual code and says, oh, this URL actually said that it should give a JSON output that looks like this, but we got some XML back. You're like, oh, whoops, I forgot to add XML. And whatever it is, you know, if it gets JSON back, it can diff on them and say, like, actually, you said that it was going to support, it said it was always going to have a string, but this value was a null. And you're like, oh, whoops, I forgot to mention that it was nullable or it accidentally came out as an integer. And so you can build those. I never talk about writing documentation because no one's writing documentation. You write API specifications so that you can be specific about what your API is going to do before you even build it. Then you have that same contract sits around to help you prototype and get feedback. And then later it helps you make sure that the API you're building matches what everyone agreed upon in those prototyping stages. And then after it's done, it's still there as documentation, which is just a HTML rendering of that OpenAPI file, and it will continue to provide contract testing throughout the entire lifetime of the API, just so that when you switch the serializer that you're using, or you switch a framework, or you switch some basic code, it doesn't just suddenly like accidentally break the output. And it does all that without you having to sit down and write giant awful unit tests where you're like, make this request, and then the response should look like this, and this field should be a string, and this field should be an integer, and this field should...
So how does OpenAPI handle something like versioning an API?
It is perfectly possible to do that. There's different ways. If you're using global versioning, then you can basically just make a different OpenAPI file for each different major version. If you are using some slightly weirder versioning, like we've done at WeWork, where we have like the old way of doing it that no one does anymore, luckily, is you might have a V1 of this thing and then a V2 of that thing and a V4 of that other thing. But you version the resources and the collections separately to each other, which is unideal. So we just mush those all in together, and then we just, you know, put at the start, like we use tag groups. You can use tag groups to basically say, here's all the V1 endpoints, here's all the V2 endpoints, here's all the V3. There's a bunch of ways of doing that stuff, but really, you should be, you know, the two options that you really want to try and do are global versioning, because it's the least gross, or evolution, which it's super good at, because you can mark specific fields or specific endpoints as deprecated. So that if you're building SDKs, like we do at WeWork, we build SDKs off of the OpenAPI specification. So when our clients start using deprecated endpoints or they use deprecated fields, the SDK can say, hey, what's going on? This field is deprecated. You should stop using it. And it throws warnings in the actual production system if you configure it to do that. So evolution is much, much, much easier if you're using a type system. That's one of the things I forgot to mention about GraphQL, which is fantastic. It's where I got the idea from to build that stuff. GraphQL basically allow you to add like a deprecated keyword next to the field in the type system. Then you get all the same warnings. It'll be gRPC does that as well via protobuf. So like all of them do the same thing now. Even though GraphQL comically doesn't have any way to deprecate an entire type, and REST does. REST has sunset, and you can just deprecate the entire endpoint. So deprecations and evolutions used to be considered really, really, really hard. But if you're using OpenAPI, it's actually quite simple. You just have to build some of the tooling yourself instead of downloading a zip file from Google.
Did that sunset header get accepted?
It's still on draft 6, but that stuff doesn't move super quickly.
No. Like,
those people have had things approved in the past, so I'm totally fine to build tooling around it. And even though it's like a development version, Eric's not just going to spin around and be like, I feel like doing this other random thing in version 7 and just change everything. So I'm fairly confident to release tooling built around Sunset as it is.
Yeah, I don't typically get terribly excited when I see most new options with the HTTP spec, but that one really stood out as a highlight to me.
Yeah, it's a tricky chicken and egg thing, because these RFCs will only ever be accepted if people use them, but no one wants to use them if they're not accepted. So at some point you have to say, this seems like a good convention that we should start building around, and hopefully it doesn't change too much. And if it does, we can kind of code to support multiple versions of the RFC. But I really hope that it gets accepted.
Yeah, it'd make a lot of things easier at work.
Yeah.
So the last question I want to bring up is the controversial one, as far as like somebody who's developing an API, they swear this is why they can't use REST anymore. And it's the N+1 problem, where they swear they cannot get everything they need in one request, or it's just inefficient. How would you address that question?
It's tricky. So first up, it depends what's going on. A lot of the time when people are trying to download a whole bunch of things, like I said, the mega include of Doom, it's because they feel like they need to have everything. I've heard this exact question before from the mobile team of the previous company, and they said, when we load up the first page, we need to have all the information about the user. We need to have the user. It was a carpooling company, so they wanted to have the rides that they were going to be going on in the next couple of days, who was going to be on those rides, and all this other stuff, just to like show the splash page, right? And they didn't want to have different things load up at different times. I was like, well, you could just have a 1 second long loading screen while you asynchronously made 10 requests in the background. Like that would be fine. That would absolutely work. But instead, they kept making this one mega request that would take like 3 or 4 seconds, because you're making one web server thread drag up all the information, smush it all together, serialize all that JSON all at the same time, and then shove it down the pipe, and you have to wait for that inflated JSON to come through in one go. And so a lot of the time, kind of trying to bulk all that stuff in together, what you're really doing is you're turning the application layer into a transportation layer, and it's bad at that. So so what you can do with, again, I keep talking about HTTP2 because bloomin' really useful. You can use HTTP2 to make a whole bunch of requests. And even though things like server push are quite complicated, right? The idea being that you would request me and then it would be like, oh, do you also want riders and trips and these other related things? That can be quite complicated. But even if you ignore that ability, you can still say, I would like to get me. And then as soon as I get that response, here is a callback, which will then go and make a request for all the second level things. And then it will be like, go and get this collection. And then you have another callback on that. And so you're basically asynchronously doing a whole bunch of stuff on the client side without even getting into server push. But there are things the client can do that aren't particularly complicated that are much better for them than just, you know, begging for this one magical endpoint that gets everything. But if there are use cases that aren't being well handled by your API, again, like BFF maybe, or more targeted resources, right? People always want to have, like, this is the way that you get users. This is the way that you get rides. This is the one canonical endpoint for the thing. And so you have to, like, download loads of data and then, like, walk through it and rebuild it and twist it and shape it and throw away the bits you don't want until you have a data structure that's useful for you. But that sounds like that sounds kind of shitty, right? If you have multiple clients that have to do that sort of thing, they might be crawling through that data in different ways and coming to different conclusions. So that's when some sort of composite resource would actually make sense. So for that company in the past, where they wanted to have this one very quick loading kind of snapshot of everything, we just made a snapshot endpoint, and that was fine. So it had like a little mini bit, it had basic user information about the current user and the time and date of the next trip. So it didn't need to call /trips and get all of your trips. It just needed to know about the next one. So we made this kind of snapshot endpoint that would have a little bit of information. And then there were URLs embedded in those areas that would be like, and here's where you go to get more. So it would have like, today you're going to be riding with Frank at 4 o'clock. And then in that little bit adjacent, it would have a link to Frank's profile that they could just follow to get all of the extra information. And if you think about how a user's actually going to browse around that iPhone application, that's where REST really comes in, because you're going to see that page, you're going to see the snapshot page, and then maybe you click on Frank's profile, and you can when you click on Frank's profile, you'll fetch that link, which fetches more information, and it's just a more realistic way of browsing around an API, which kind of is more in line with the UI. And if your API is massively out of line with the client's needs in such a way that the client can't do its job very well, then the client either needs to be talking to a more targeted API, or maybe you should have some more targeted endpoints.
Right. Those sound like great tips. So is there anything else you wanted to cover before we wrap up? Is there anything that I left out, or just anything you want to talk about?
I'm sure I'll remember as soon as I hang up.
Yeah, as these things go.
Yeah, always the way.
So if people want to follow along with what you're doing, how can they best do that?
Phil.bike is where I talk about bikes, so everyone can ignore that. It's completely irrelevant. No, I get like 10 readers on every article. But if you go to apisyouwonthate.com, that is the home for most of what I do. There's my old book, and there's the new book I'm working on, Surviving Other People's APIs. And there's a blog on there, which...
It's a great title. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I love the artwork for it. I got the designers to do like a... I didn't even think of it. Someone recommended it. It's like an Indiana Jones style like thing, because you have this API and it's the instructions are ancient, you know, tomes that don't really make any sense, and you're trying to figure it all out and get using this API, and then all of a sudden you step on the wrong thing and the floor falls away and there's spikes. That's how I can often feel navigating dodgy APIs. So it's a whole book about, it's for the client side. Things to look out for, things that can help you learn what type of API paradigm they're using and how you should interact with it, and kind of teaches you the client side stuff for REST. So, or the client side, like when you should retry requests, which requests you should retry and which requests you really, really shouldn't, things like that. And there's a blog on there where I release a whole bunch of articles about API specifications and some sneak chapters from the books and things like that.
Excellent. Well, thanks for coming on to talk to me today. I found it very enlightening. I hope people get a lot of value from it.
Yeah, I hope so too. And thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Take care. Thanks for listening.